Welcome to The Inevitable, a podcast by Motor Trend.
Hi there, and welcome to The Inevitable podcast from Motor Trend, where we talk about the coming age of electrification, autonomous cars, connected cars, where this is all going, how are we going to get there, the future of mobility, or as my host, co-host Johnny Lieberman says, the future of the car.
Yeah.
Hi, Johnny. How are you?
Hey, Ed. I'm doing good. I'm excited. Good. This is going to be a fun show. Jonathan Ward is our guest. And are you into ASMR at all?
Sure, a little bit.
I'm not at all. But if I was, it would just be him saying like acronyms. I have no idea what they mean, but I love him listing out like all this crazy stuff he's working on.
Yes. And he is very near and dear to my heart because I'm a bit of a Land Cruiser junkie.
Yeah.
And he's like the originator of sort of the premium Land Cruiser experience with his company.
His first company was TLC, Toyota yep. Land Cruiser, but TLC.
TLC 4x4.
And they would do these really great restorations and modifications
right.
of Land Cruisers. And then he started Icon, which is a whole other
thing. Kind of out of TLC.
Yeah, so where do you take it next,
yes.
right? So the idea was no plastic whatsoever in a modern FJ. What would that be like?
Right.
And then it became Jeeps and Broncos and trucks and then these derelicts and these reformers. And
right.
kind of – it's weird like to be friends with a person that I shouldn't say this, but I look up to so much because I think what he does is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And now he's going EV.
He's going EV.
He's actually
I would say a little bit of a pioneer in that regard. He's not like the first guy to do by any means the first guy to put a electric powertrain in
another vehicle. Eberhard and the guy that founded Tesla.
Right.
They took a 911 turbo and electrified it. I think was the
but to do it I think in this way it, with where the style I think leads.
Yeah.
I think is a very a different sort of a proposition.
And he's trying to do it. I hate the word, but like holistically. So he's not just dropping in an EV motor. It's trying to make a really good product at the same time.
Right. Which leads me to the question of the day what's your experience been in driving these sort of Frankenstein vehicles? I'm trying to rack my brains. I don't think I've ever driven, and we really need to, driven a Rustomod or an EV swapped.
Very little. I for a lot of reasons, I'm sort of turned off by them. I did drive briefly the Icon derelict. There was a 49 Mercury that was an EV, very briefly. But why am I turned off?
Yeah,
And again, I'm not the biggest I don't spend a lot of time in the garage wrenching on cars, but I've done a little bit of it. And especially on a 911 or a Ferrari or something, those engines are such little works of art. Even Volkswagens, just everything stamped with the little VW logo, and it's done. And to rip that out and replace it with an RC motor, for lack of a better term, there's something sacrilegious about it. I have no problem with brand new EVs that never had a really cool internal combustion engine, but man, if you're taking out a great engine, even and I know they're junkyards are full of them, but even a Chevy small block, just such a cool feat of engineering to rip that out and replace it, kind of unnecessarily.
Hmm.
I guess you're not really burning gas, but how much gas would one existing car really burn? I don't know. It's just to me, it's kind of been a turnoff. I love looking at engines. I love – again, I don't really wrench on them, but I respect people who know how to do it. I love looking at what they've done. I don't know. That's kind of my
problem. But so no interest in the
problem.
Driving? You want to know what a super lightweight, a 60s or 70s or 80s era vehicle with all of the mechanical bits stripped out, and then it's not going to be necessarily lighter, but you're going to get something that's way more power and torque dense.
I don't even like removing the inline six from a Toyota FJ and putting in a Chevy V8. I just feel like it hasn't really been engineered like that. There was a team at Toyota that did that, and it represents a time and a space and a way the world was. And you're kind of corrupting that. I know you put a small block in your 914. yes, you get big power, but you're losing like the 914-ness of the thing.
And the thing that people forget too is once you start down that path, especially with – yes, with Land Cruisers, but also anything you're going to put a small block in, the car was not designed to handle that amount of power and torque. And then so everything else downstream of that then needs to be upgraded. First of all, the brakes and then probably the suspension because the thing's heavier.
The differential, I mean everything. Stuff. Yeah.
But I think it's – I can't figure out why. I'm not questioning like why I haven't had more opportunities. I think it's really – I haven't had that many opportunities.
You're busy.
A little busy. But also like
– we're kind of busy, Ed. You forget that.
Right. Yeah. But to get behind the wheel of more of these sort of Frankenstein vehicles, there have been offers. I just
– Well, I mean look, to be fair, like Motor Trend, we tend to deal with new metal, right? We deal with like what is an OEM, what is a manufacturer going to give us for a week? And we drive press cars. And even getting together, you know, I've been friends with Jonathan for 14 years, whatever it's been, 15 years. It's hard for me to carve out time to get together with him because he doesn't really have press cars. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, hey, can you be here on this day to drive it for this 30-minute window that I have? And it's like, no, I can't. I'm busy. So it's hard the way our lives are constructed to do that. But should we? Yeah, especially now that we're doing this new inevitable initiative.
Right.
We got to become expert on everything. But how do you feel about ripping out a 911 flat six and putting in an EV motor? As a 911 owner,
I love it because it increases the value of my vehicle, theoretically.
Would you do it to your vehicle?
No, never.
Wait, why not your vehicle? Because yours is an investment piece?
But yeah, it's my kid's college fund.
It's also
low miles. It's basically it's more or less perfect. I would definitely consider it for I would say something maybe slightly less iconic.
What about your Land Cruiser, which has a junky old polluting, lung cancer causing
diesel? It's awesome.
Yeah, which you're going to give
you
kid
asthma. I don't. I wouldn't touch that one either. I would.
So you're saying you're against it?
No. I would do something with something a little more. I think there's definitely applications that are attractive. I would love to do a vintage Volkswagen bus. I think that'd be really cool. Like, really, if you could harness the skateboard platform and do what we're waiting for VW to do, that would be amazing.
And also, those engines have all been swapped 1,000 times.
Exactly.
What about a 2014 Ford Fiesta ST that's engine just blew up and they're about to tell me it's going to be $8,000?
Yes.
Yeah.
Who might have one of those?
Yeah. What do you think? Do you think that could be a project?
I was going to ask you, tongue in cheek, because you said you're not a fan of vehicles that have the engine removed. It wasn't designed from the start. It loses some of its sort of innate qualities. So then, how do you feel about like an Audi e-tron, like the first one, like which is essentially like the transitional. Like in the museum of electric vehicles, you're going to have these transitional vehicles that basically tried to stuff the battery and the motor under the hood to make the thing sort of work.
You realize your phone's about to blow up with Mark from Audi being like, no, it's a clean sheet. But the first Mercedes EQS, it was that GLC.
Right.
That they did just rip out the engine and transmission and put in batteries and electric motors. Yeah, they're going to be what they are. It's like failures. It's an invisible Frankenstein.
You can't see evolutionary step. We'll say you
can't see the bolt sticking out of the neck. But they had no range. They had no. It was doing what we're talking about. You're removing something that was a gazillion hours of engineering went into that, and much less went into these stopgap machines. I think we'll see that now.
Golf E, Fiat 500e.
We're still seeing this. Remember just back to SUV of the year. We were both at it this year. Remember the Volkswagen, the ID.4, where even that, that probably – I think it is some sort of EV platform. But, they didn't go far enough with it. You can't open
the
hood. There's no frunk. Whereas, every other EV is going to have a frunk. You know what I mean? So that's still a half measure.
I mean,
three quarter measure.
At least in version 1.0, right? Like everybody is now. I think we've arrived at the skateboard design, the batteries in the floor, the motors generally between the wheels or at each wheel.
Yep.
That is the prevailing design of the day. But man, if the batteries start shrinking, getting lighter.
Maybe the body's made out of batteries.
Yes. I'm looking forward to the day where all of this stuff gets even more flexible and lighter,
I mean, that I'd love to talk to Jonathan about that because, like, you know, like what again? And I really want this question answered as, you know, as we get through this podcast. Like, when cars no longer have steering wheels, forget about just electrification. There's no pedals. You don't need a driver to sit in a driver's seat. What does a car look like?
Right.
And I hope it's just not a bus, but I hope, like, what's the possibility? Or does it not even matter what they look like at that point because you're probably not going to even own them. You just hail one when you need it.
Right. Shared mobility, right? Future
sharing cars. Would you ever – could I go drive your 930? Like, you know what I mean? Like,
no.
You
wouldn't, but in that future, like, nobody would be driving it, right? Like,
if there's no steering wheel.
Well, it's like sharing the road with horses. Mm-hmm. You know, we used to do that when there's a switchover, and now, you know, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, horses it's just a very minor thing. Some people still love horses, and there's still a lot of money to be made. And I would argue that the most expensive horse today is worth a billion times more than the most expensive horse 100 years ago.
Right.
And that might happen very well with, like, internal combustion cars.
We're going to end up in going to, like, special areas, like ranches, like these or racetracks where you can just drive your internal combustion engine.
Do you know how to ride a horse?
Yes.
Okay, so do I. But do you think, like, very few people – like, used to be everyone knew how to
ride
a horse.
I know how to ride a horse and that I can get on it and put my feet in the stirrups and, like –
A lot of people don't know that. But, like, you know, we were talking about people know how to drive stick. Like, it might be a future where it's like, do you know how to drive a car? Like, nah.
Are you crazy? Like, why would I want to do that? You could really hurt yourself.
Right. Really dangerous. Yeah. It's true. It's a weird future we're working towards here.
Yeah. Well, let's talk to Jonathan.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that would be this is a great
he's
segue.
He's thought about this a lot.
He's a deep thinker. Good-looking dude. Just saying it for his benefit. When he hears this.
Yeah, odd transition there, Ed. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, great. Let's welcome him in. He's again, a guy I really want to talk to about the future of automotive, particularly because he's so rooted in, I think, these transitional steps, right? He has a deep appreciation for the vehicles. Again, he's a huge Land Cruiser nerd.
And he's a geek. I mean, he's really into stuff.
Yeah. Hands-on, watches, leather, the whole thing.
Yeah. All right, this is going to be good.
Bring him on.
We talk about all things related to electric vehicles here on The Inevitable. So if you're interested in Tesla, don't miss Ride the Lightning, the Tesla unofficial podcast, hosted every week by longtime Tesla owner and superfan Ryan McCaffrey.
On episode 200, he conducted an hour-long interview with Elon Musk. On episode 220, he talked to Tesla's chief designer. And he's there in person covering every big Tesla event.
Ride the Lightning also recaps and analyzes everything happening with the world's biggest EV automaker each week.
Hear about the latest Cybertruck developments, the next-gen Roadster, the Model S Plaid, plus the newest updates to the Model 3, X, Y, and more. New episodes have been dropping every Sunday since 2015, so jump in and enjoy. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts, your favorite podcast service, or check it out at patreon.com/Tesla podcast.
That's Ride the Lightning, the Tesla unofficial podcast.
Well, we are excited to have our guest here today, Jonathan Ward.
Howdy.
Howdy. Great to have you here. A man of many talents, leatherworking, Land Cruiser rebuilding, vehicle resto-modding. I was actually going to ask you whether I can use that word, if you like that terminology.
What to call what we do, and that seems like the simplest combination that explains it, and I'm down with that.
For Icon.
Designer as well.
Designer.
Pretty solid designer.
Watch nerd.
Watch geek.
Man of many talents. Mr. Jonathan Ward, again, thank you for being here, talking about the future of mobility, future of the car. Is it inevitable? My understanding is you have deep potentially dark thoughts about this.
I do. And maybe I've thought a little too much about it. I'm into it. I enjoy technology. But I think my biggest inner conflict with it is just in the ICE world, pre-EV mentality. Even when it came to, like, all the perversions of modernity and the creature comforts and the CAN bus little, you know, does the dome light dim down in 5 seconds or 10 seconds, like, and all these things, they're corrupting, right? So every time my wife gets a new car, there's some new little subtle gizmo or functionality that is enticing. But at the same time, I've been careful to avoid those things that I think are superfluous in they're not adding enough value, but they're creating an opportunity for something to go wrong. And I felt that past a point, you're creating something that's going to age out and is disposable. And if there's one thing in all my craftsmanship endeavors, I'm just a serial craftsman, and like the car thing started as a hobby, and many of my hobbies then they'll get perverted and turn into businesses. But even heated seats, right? It took a while. Took my wife's car, new Land Cruiser at the time, many years ago. Took it surfing one morning, and I'm always like, I don't need no navigation. I don't, you know, kind of an old grump. And oh man, I like that heated seat. Oh, that's good. So I'm like, okay, I'm gonna put heated seats in the Icons. But you know, okay, who makes the best one, and what's the best functionality? So I think at root, my biggest concern is I've always had a certain pride in the focus that we're kind of recycling, upcycling vehicles that are often perceived to be at the end of their usable life cycle, right? What really scares me about EV, and I'm in the middle of that right now, is the technology is moving so quickly. And we're talking iPhone fast, right? That am I taking something and upcycling it into a scenario where its moment in time is extremely temporary and therefore is disposable? And I have a concern with that.
That's a great point. So just everyone, if you're not familiar with what Jonathan does specifically at Icon, I first met you 14 years ago, whatever it was.
Yeah, at least.
And you were taking Toyota FJs, which you're still doing. And you, my understanding is every single part except for the hood is replaced, essentially, the chassis plate and the hood.
Yeah.
And turning it into these like incredible – resto mod is not the right word – just vehicles. And I remember, you know, the prices are high. Let's just be frank about that. And you know, I went in like, well, why is at the time it was only worth like $200,000. And I remember I'd say, well, why is this, you know, Toyota FJ worth $200,000?
I can do this for $40,000,
$6,000. But yeah. I'll never forget you turned to me, you're like, well, you know, for instance, like the latch here that releases the windshield. Like we spent a lot of time looking at latches, and I figured out that the 1905 Sub-Zero fridge has the coolest latch, so that's what we're using. And I was like, oh, this is a different type of car. But along with that, looking backwards, you've also been, in my opinion, very forward-looking. You've always talked to me about EVs. I want to do an EV this. I want to do an EV that. You did do a 1949 Mercury derelict,
right,
which is a super patinaed car, but you stuck a electric motor and
Art
battery
Morrison
in there.
Morrison chassis, right?
And
then, yeah, four-wheel independent, Brembos, electric rack and pinion, dual
Tesla
power
AMR
train.
Motors, Tesla P90 battery array, and then a crazy complicated CAN bus operating system.
Right.
So
– and you did that. I mean, this has now been a thing. It's starting to gain in popularity. Rich Rebuilds, like these guys on the online. Like when did you start that project?
You wanted to do a Thriftmaster.
Yeah. So before the Merc, I did two very cut and dry, simple EV conversions. We did how do you pronounce it? Gardenero, a Fiat 600 Gardenero, little two-door wagon. Right. We did VW Thing. I've always been a big fan of those. And those weren't very pioneering. You know, they were still to the stock transmission through a spud shaft to a plate to a single motor. And while that was sort of like dipping my toe in the pond, okay, is this going to work out? Does it make sense? But then being the idiot that I am, I looked at it and was like, well, okay, that's kind of neat, but – not only those, but I really feel that in the EV aftermarket, non-OEM world, I think there's two areas of growth in the market, and the manufacturers and the packagers are still trying to figure out what are they doing.
Right.
Is it DIY, dumb it down as cheap as possible, simple, I can mail order a kit and party on, or is it really OEM quality integration and safety and performance and system monitoring and double stopgap and all that. And I obviously have always been about revisiting classic transportation in a modern context. So this dovetails perfectly into our ethos. But after those first two, I was like, okay, well, what happens when someone takes a retrofitted EV vehicle and let's say they go up to Big Bear. They charge it all night. Then they go downhill for 2.5 hours. Where are those ions going to go?
Right. up in flames. Like, there's so many things that I felt were sacrificed for the sake of barrier of entry, price point, and simplicity. And I don't like that. Like, I want the OEM refinement, and I want the safety. I want to have Tesla fast charge capability, right, and or CHAdeMO, or, you know, have the versatility, have significantly more performance and thermal management. Like, almost no one still in the EV aftermarket world's thinking or bothering with thermal management. Right. At most, they have like a little glycerin pump with a little clear tube to show green moving, and it really doesn't do. And if you look at the thermal cycles, right, the batteries, the BMSs, the controllers, the motors, they all have completely unique thermodynamic needs. Mm. So that's something that we really use that Merck to kind of hemorrhage time and money to try and progressively pioneer more OEM-like.
So, yeah, systems. So when did you do those first two and then versus the derelict?
Oh, I suck at chronologic memory. I think 4 and 5 years ago for the first two.
Okay.
And then the Merck, you know, the Merck was technically completed and shown at SEMA, 2 years ago?
Okay.
But here's a good case in point. Yeah. It's still at my shop.
Before the pandemic. Because remember we had dinner.
So maybe 3 years.
Yeah, we had dinner with that first charity thing we did together done in at Sang's.
But here's the catch. The client is really cool. We've done repeat vehicles for him. When he first approaches, dude, I'm like, hell yeah, I'm in. But if I'm going to do more EVs, here's what I think's important and I haven't seen done and I want to do. And he said, hell yeah, I agree. Let's go. I said, well, you're my chipmunk. Like, this, I can't give you a time estimate. I can't give you a financial estimate because we don't know. We know where we want to get. But the engineers and internal and sublet that we had to engage to be so pioneering is kind of my Achilles heel because I ended up shooting myself in my foot. So that car, by the time we finished it and it was running and driving, two significant systems within the car, the manufacturers reached out, hey, we now have the ability to do this. Oh, we now went to an AN5 so we can increase and on and on and on. And I'm that goober who's not going to be like, screw it. It runs, it drives, it stops, ship it.
It's not good enough. Yeah.
It's not good enough. Yeah. It's the Raymond Loewy never leave good enough alone syndrome. Right. It's got to be a good acronym there. And so the car's still at my shop because these new opportunities, the tech again is moving so quickly. I don't want to deliver an iPhone 7 when the 14 just came out.
Right. How much is the software an issue? How much is the
significant? I mean, honestly, in my experience, the only player in the game right now who's even getting to the realm of being capable of monitoring so many systems in detail is AEM.
Right.
But AEM is doing it with kind of archaic software foundations. It's, I mean, literally could be like a black screen with a blinking green cursor and your ability to really control and refine it is surprisingly limited. Right. But they are by far way ahead of everybody else.
Right.
But then the OEMs, you know, now you've got, what is it, Global B with GM and all these new systems. They're not just CAN, which is a show in its own right. For listeners who aren't electrical geeks, basically, you know, you've got 6-volt cars, then you got 12-volt cars, and then some of the Brits for some reason switched to negative-positive grounds just to really confuse us. Then came OBD2, right? And it was like, oh, my God, it's so complicated. Well, it kind of was, but it's all X's and O's, yes's and no's, limited signal, and limited networking of those signals. Right. Now you enter OBD2. The damn dome light is talking to the ABS.
Oh, yeah.
Everything is talking to everything. Mm-hmm. So if you want to take all of the finesse that system provides and monkey with it, I'm trying to put it in a non-native platform and trick it into thinking it's still stock. Even like that's why a lot of these modern cars, like with the G-Wagons, I hear people talking, you change the wheel tire weight. You can go around a turn, not very rowdy, and suddenly the computer will apply brakes to the rear right wheel.
Yep.
It's a show.
How much, like, you know, going to referencing Murphy's Law, you know, everything's, you know, twice as complicated as you first thought. Like, how much more difficult was it to do that Mercury and to do your upcoming EV projects than you initially thought?
Basically, my wife, who's my CFO, and Sharif, who's my COO,
have reprogrammed my brain, and I'm no longer allowed to even spell, write, use, say the word easy.
Right. But how much more?
Chill.
Yeah.
Chill.
Okay.
Again, run, drive, stop, charge, kick it out. Easy. Thermal systems that are, electric AC and heating systems to keep everything at peak operating and for longevity and all that.
I had a funny talk with, he's a new CEO of AMG. I forget his first name, but Ubler is his last name.
Oh, I didn't know there was a change.
Yeah, Tobias went to Aston Martin.
He'll be missed.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. But the new guy's good, but we were talking about, their Project One, which has an F1 motor. And he goes, it's totally, I'm part of the problem. He goes, I was in the room when we said, hey, let's put an F1 motor in a streetcar.
Great
How hard
idea.
Could it be? And he goes, well, because we love F1. What all of us missed was to turn on an F1 car, there's 10 people with PhDs. Each, there's a guy that turns on the brakes. There's a bank of supercomputers that runs the brakes. So we had to come up with, when you hit the start button, you have 10 PhD level experts, digitally talk to each other.
Yeah.
And, when somebody adjusts the seat heater, that's going to affect every other, like the most mega complex system of all. It does seem like it, for someone in your position, Stellantis yesterday announced they're going to go from 1,000 software engineers to 4,500.
Oh, yeah. Ralph's cooking up some serious EV stuff.
Sure. I imagine you're not going to have 4,500 software engineers down.
I got one who's about ready to kill me.
Yeah, right. So how do you compete? How do you do this?
Well, that's another issue. Like I'd love to see the OEMs be more open with their EV science, but obviously ain't going to happen.
Right.
There was a funny story years ago. I was developing a concept I was calling the Helios that was like based. I love sort of
oh,
like
that thing was
design
killer.
Perspectives
yeah.
of like sort of revisionist history. So like, what if the Depression hadn't come when it did and sort of limited, curtailed certain design languages.
Right.
So like Streamline Modern was killing it. But then there was sort of the, less focus on that. There was a pullback. There was the Industrial Revolution where then quantity ruled over quality. So what if also – if those hadn't occurred when they occurred, and what if transportation design had taken inspiration from aircraft design maybe 10, 15 years earlier. Like, what would that car look like if Howard Hughes got drunk with Gordon Buhrig and Buckminster Fuller at the Beverly Hills Hotel and said, there's this one last starlet I've not slept with and I'm going to take her to the movie premiere,
right.
Build me a car. What would that car look like? So started putting that together, and I wanted to build it with all Tesla guts. And this is before Rich or anyone was on the scene doing that. And some of the engineers, key engineer team at Tesla got wind of it. And I still have a copy of the letter, and it said the title was like peanut butter and chocolate. And it was them asking Elon, please let us support this geek to make this happen. And like, I was like, I don't care. I'll buy the car. I'll fund the project. But like, I'm going to need behind the curtain support,
right.
No. It's zero interest.
Sure. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, zero. Okay. I mean, I'm just a liability.
Yeah.
And so you see all the guys that are taking wrecked Teslas, they get blacklisted. They can't get EEPROM updates. They can't get software updates. They can't even get service parts.
Yeah, right? We mentioned this on another show, but there's that company Unplugged Performance. Mm-hmm. They made the Pikes Peak Racer, yep. the Plaid that Randy Popes drove. And they have – I'm probably going to get the guy shot or something. But they have like an insider at Tesla that like – he's like, we need a patch that like really actually eliminates the stability control. Yeah.
Right.
But like he was so nervous when I was writing an article about the car. He's like, just don't mention. I don't remember what it was. Like, don't mention X, because then like ah, and so that's it's so
now
like,
he's fired.
And
now you mentioned it twice.
Yeah, whatever. Come on. They know I'm a journalist.
You've done that to me too, but I still love you.
Yeah, I think look, I write for Motor Trend and I'm on at least 17 podcasts.
But I have learned that journalists supersedes everything. So like, you got to be careful with this.
But people love telling me secrets. They just love
it. True.
Yeah. Because they want it out there. That's what they really.
Oh, now you're like, self-empowering.
No, if you talk to Freud, like they're it's not.
Does that include when they tell you this is really cool, but don't tell anyone?
Right.
And then tell you?
Well, why would they tell me anything?
See how you are?
Right. Yeah.
Trouble.
Yeah, yeah,
trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's go back. Scorpion by the river. So OEM level refinement, epic, hundreds, thousands of engineers and tens of millions of dollars making some really cool I can't compete with that. So with partners like AEM or someone that, you know, we can collaborate with to accelerate the technology, I'm down with that. So like this one key thing that I always thought was odd, mostly driven by the do-it-yourself world, is the stupid concept of attaching an electric motor to a conventional automotive transmission.
Right.
The amount of energy scavenging that goes down and the fact that none of the gear ratios make any logical sense,
right.
That sucks.
Yep.
So like with the Merc, we did direct drive dual electric motors, and I can't tell you the pain we went through in drive shafts, honeycomb, carbon, Kevlar, aluminum, steel, and on and on to get that big donkey of a drive shaft to be balanced at the sort of RPMs it's traveling. But the technology didn't exist yet, except for Marine. There were gear drive reducers, but they're notoriously loud. So I was always, man, I wish someone would come up with like a planetary gear, like kind of like the foundation of the Prius transmission. Like, give me a 2-to-1 and then game on.
Right.
Well, now there's 3 in the market.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to start prototyping and testing equations.
So, that's great. That's a great lead into my next question, which is, so you, because you kind of mentioned those two parallel paths, kind of the DIY and then the sort of factory warranty solution. What's your take on the General Motors approach and the Ford approach, Illuminator for Ford, and then their E-Crate solution for GM? Do you have?
I think it's. I think it's media grab impressions. Look how conscious we are and we're engaged in this. Because, for example, at Ford, and I have friends and love plenty of things about the Ford and GM, yada, 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 disclaimer. But when at SEMA they show that crate motor out of the E-Mach.
Mach-E. Yep.
It doesn't. Okay, great. What are you going to do with it? What a fancy, beautiful doorstop you now have, or maybe make a cool lamp out of it. But without providing control packs and operating systems and the ability to adjust for different platforms, it's smoke and mirrors. It's and the GM one, same deal. Dear Jamie Meyer, who's since retired from there, but when they were developing that, I was super excited. Well, the majority of that work, like 90% of that, was done by the university, not by GM. Then GM hitched the wagon to it so they can make the press release, look how progressive we are. Where's the beef? Product's still not out. Battery pack, modular batteries, where are they?
Right.
So like Ford, I had like smart automotive buddies of mine all excited. And I just bought one, you know. I was like, okay, have fun with that.
Right.
But I unfortunately feel it's just a shallow positioning move. You know, if either OEM or any OEM does offer not just a pretty little motor that spins, but a BMS, modular battery systems, adjustable software with
BMS is battery management system.
Then it's nothing. It's useless.
Right.
It's hard enough when Ford comes out with a new Coyote to make the damn thing run, because Ford Performance. They're traditionally GM's been the best at this. Ford, though, like when the Coyote comes out, like, well, wait a minute. What about a Fiat kit? Yeah, we've got a Fiat. Yeah, but there's no power steering. Oh, yeah, we run the E-Pass in the stock app. So I'm like, okay, well, what about, you know, this is a crate motor. Let the aftermarket come out.
So is there any way to ever simplify any of this, or does it just get more and more complicated?
Well,
as EVs become more and more, you know, capable and powerful.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, think about the perspective, right? There's a couple ways to look at it. My dumb going into it looked at it. Well, in my world, I'm already having to source, buy, or engineer and create suspension, axles, brakes, fuel system, exhaust system, and yada, yada, yada. Well, if I go EV and I displace just the fundamental quantity of ICE components, that's a lot less purchase orders I'm slinging, and it's theoretically a much simpler system.
Right.
Well, that's by the way, that's what, you know, we don't talk about this. That's one of the big reasons all OEMs are going electric, is because once the price of batteries does drop below, you know, $100 a kilowatt hour, it's a lot cheaper to build these things.
No,
yeah.
But you know, the funny thing is that makes sense if it's 1901 and we're debating an electric car versus an internal combustion
car. So what's the difference?
Because they're not neither are as simple as they were in their most rudimentary early sense.
Gotcha.
For an EV to be what we all want it to be and to be engaging and to be safe and to be viable and, most importantly, in my little odd brain, not disposable. There's a lot more that's got to go down to make that all work.
Sensors in the software in the EV and on the ICE side.
And I fear that the catch-22 that we're going to see culturally is already like when's the last time you saw a 600 series V12 Benz is 10 years old? Like the attrition rate is crazy because of the innate complexity of the platform. Even good old Toyota, which I have massive respect for, they studied from Microsoft when Microsoft started doing laptops. And then when the batteries would die, people would go buy another Microsoft laptop, not a battery.
Right.
Well, Toyota, especially with the Land Cruiser through Arakawa, which became Arako,
right. No.
The idea was make it as strong and as simple as possible to last as long as possible. And I think there was significant personal electronics business perspective that came into automotive because Toyota went, well, wait a minute, why would we do that? Hmm. That's stupid. Like, let's make it strong enough and good enough to last through the warranty cycle and people get rid of it and come back. When you get into EV, okay, fine, you know, less brake work, there's less fluids. Definitely the less oil derivative content is of significant performance, and like the way Rivian's thinking about it, where it's – and Volvo is doing a lovely job of thinking that through all the way through to the textiles, right?
Right.
I value that. But I think we're getting to the point that now perhaps they're studying Adobe, you know, and going to a subscription model.
Right.
But
right.
The longevity is not going to be there. So I fear in 10 years the landfills are going to be – the junkyards are going to be fuller than ever with
EVs.
Late model vehicles. And we're going to see GDPs propped up, right, because more manufacturer, more turnover, more and more people, it's lease or subscribe. That's it. But I think the longevity is going to be even more limited. I mean, but look at the Prius.
And well,
still going
strong. Sure. What, in your opinion, makes a car disposable?
Well, I think fundamentally it's the design and engineering theology at root at inception. And then also the more and more we get into electronics, the more we get into consumer habits and taste of, you know, you dump your phone in a year and get the next one.
Right.
You're back to CAN bus because it has a couple
but
more
then Tesla,
perversions.
Tesla's been a leader in a number of ways, obviously, but with like over-the-air updates,
yes.
Like you can constantly, assuming you put the right chip in or you have enough throughput, right, you have enough memory, you've just connected it correctly, you can constantly add. I remember when we had the – what was it? We had the original Model S. I think it was like the P70
mm-hmm.
or
P75.
P75, and then like they unlocked it for us overnight and turned it into like a P85.
It was a P60 to a P75.
Then they just unlocked – and because they never sold that. They decided they were going to stop selling the P60. Like you can bake it in, unlock it, or add features. And I think about this a lot. Model S, the original Model S, has been out since late 2012. Yes, it had the nose job. It's got a new front bumper like 5 or 6 years ago. Still looks sharp. We talk about how it's got amazing proportions. And yes, they did a giant update to the interior.
Thank God.
And they actually did a giant update to the motors and batteries recently, too. Yeah. But it looks the same.
That thing could theoretically that doesn't follow the traditional automotive product
Correct.
Cycle.
And I really value how disruptive he has been in many models in changing that. But I think there comes a point, if you look at literally almost any other industry, at some point that is to the consumer's or planet's deficit.
Well,
so
to your point,
you get that update and, oh, wait a minute, it's not compatible with this. Now that works different or that's no longer supported. Look at my CNCs. Haas did a deal where they changed native software platforms and literally with no notice overnight told everyone, yeah, if your CNC is built pre this date, we're no longer supporting it.
This is a Haas CNC machine for fabricating parts and Haas is also the Formula One racing team. Wait, are they still in?
But this happens all the time with software where like, okay, we're done supporting this version of Illustrator or whatever it is, right? But, you know, with like the phone, for instance, and I think you're really onto something because like, I have an iPhone 12. There's really nothing wrong with it.
And that last update created problems.
No, not even that. I just want the new one just because I want the new one. I don't know why. Maybe the camera's like 8% better. Maybe it's 8%. But I take pictures of my kids. That better be 8% better. I want an 8% better photo. And, you know, I think cars, because of the barrier to entry is so much higher. They're so much more expensive than a new iPhone.
Yeah.
You know, I think that it won't be as rapid as a turnover. But even what you're talking about, because you're about to announce some new EVs. Are you comfortable talking about this?
Yeah, I'm starting Q1.
Yeah. This airs in Q1, by the way.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Starting now.
Starting
right now. We're definitely making moves to electrify our production models.
And that means the FJ and the Bronco.
Yes, the FJ, the Bronco, and the Thrift Masters.
So are those disposable now, or do you bring them back to you and get...
Damn good point. It makes me nervous.
All right.
That's been a big part of my reservations.
What's keeping you up at
doing
night?
It.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So we've always built our vehicles quasi-submodular in that... you've seen my electrical harnesses. Like, my wire harnesses are out of control and unnecessarily sexy. And so we'll have three primary systems that go.
That could be the title of your autobiography, though.
Unnecessarily sexy. As long as it's not a picture of me.
Massive
kick-ass aerospace bulkheads that tie three principal harnesses to a united network. So if the Coyote or the LS3 or whatever is a boat anchor in 10 years, you technically can disconnect that, remove that powertrain as a submodule and move forward. So I'm thinking the same thing with our EV builds. And I'm also – part of me – like, our resale value shocks me. Like, it is killer. For custom vehicles, traditionally, it's like the worst investment you can possibly make.
Right.
I'm routinely seeing
But you've been
in
an iconoclast stuff. With like – You don't cut a corner. That's the difference with Icon and a lot of other
shops.
Yeah,
and I think the market fortunately is respecting.
Yeah,
that.
You don't. I mean, you know,
the liability there is if I'm seeing my vehicle sell for more than they sold to the person who originally commissioned them, that's a pride moment. Like, I don't even get a dollar of that. Whatever. It's not an NFT. Oh, that'd be NFT.
Yeah. We'll talk about that later.
okay, that's great because the brand equity is by far the most important thing to me. I've done tons of moves that are perhaps asinine for the sake of my P&L to make sure that my brand equity and what is important to me is communicated through the brand in the hopes that when I'm long gone, in 50 years, 60 years, you're at a car show and someone sees, if there's still car shows, sees an icon, it means something and they knew what it represented. But if I start doing EVs and people change them out like underwear and it goes back on the resale market in 2 years, is the residual value going to tank? So I'm trying to think that through, and I don't think I do enough volume, although we talked to Putman and a couple companies about just leasing them so that we bring them back, recon, submodularly update. I'm also worried about
service. Who destroyed
the
electric icon?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Chris was like, don't do it.
Yeah.
So I struggle with that. But,
I struggle to understand why they would devalue over time the quality is like nosebleed high.
But now it's about the quality of the tech. So let's say the first one I deliver year one has a 200 mile range and 400 foot pounds of torque and it can do this and it can do that. And then 2 years later, the tech has moved so far that now it's 500-mile range. It's 700 foot-pounds of torque. And you can plug in a generator and turn it into a hybrid that's self-supportive with 15 kW that now can run a remote office or geological survey site and expands the utility into actual industrial viability. What's that? You know, I worry that the tech's going to move so quick that the ones that we build represent a moment in time.
So why then now?
Because I think that –
is it inevitable? Sorry.
It's inevitable. And I firmly believe in the sort of global priorities of doing it.
Right.
And I will risk my – I'll go through the risk. I'll engage them. Plus, again, to me, the torque splitter concept, the gear reduction, the 2-to-1, that was really the most critical missing link to deliver a successful product. Plus, I kind of got sick of – I mean, so many people have come into this space, and you remember when we were the first idiots in this space, and both you remember yours, right? And everyone's like, wait, you're going to do what? Only what? For how much? Now it's on one part, it's beautiful to see the level of community and shops that have come into this space from, you know, Singer to people you've never heard of. What I kind of get a little butthurt about is companies that their whole business model is, we're just like Icon, but we're cheaper and quicker.
Yeah.
And they're not.
Right.
And it's like, dude, design your own.
Right.
Product.
Like, you've actually mentored a friend of mine, or you've at least had a chat with him, Mark Davis.
Love Mark.
At Moment Motors
and
out
he
of Austin.
And, you know what? That's a two-way street. He's a super intelligent guy.
Yeah.
We've learned a lot from each other, and if we lived in town, we'd go through a lot of scotch because we do a lot of co-consulting. It's more commiserating, probably.
Right. So Mark runs a Restomod or a restoration of a facility that converts vintage cars into electric vehicles. Yeah. He's been at it for now 4 years or
yeah,
so.
Yeah, 4 or 5. Just moved to a bigger shop. He's in Austin, Texas. Lovely guy. Beautiful work.
And yeah. It's funny because you were pretty hard on Ford and GM, and he's like super excited actually about particularly the General Motors E-Crate solution because he told me because we went to SEMA, we checked out both, and he said the same thing about the Ford Illuminator. He's like, look, it looks great. It looks the show vehicle, the truck, amazing. But what are they actually giving you? You know, no controller, no inverter. Like at least, and I'm not sure that's entirely accurate from because so little information was provided at the
show.
From
the people I talked to directly at Ford, that's all there is right now. And they put, I think, 30 of them in stock at great resistance because they can't deliver enough Mach-Es anyway in time for the media blitz. But I don't mean to bust their ass in that if they are going to offer the complete system, hell yeah. I'd love that. Then maybe in a perfect world, right? Suddenly we have access to GM tech centers and dealers for maintenance for remote clients because hardly any of my clients are local.
Right.
I just get disappointed by our industry quite often. I think there's a lot of smoke and mirrors.
Sure.
There are a lot
greenwashing
of – greenwashing. Yeah, greenwashing is the big newest one.
Worry about,
and companies that come out of nowhere with these digital renders and we're going to do this and we're going to do that and like really, come on.
So does that mean that you are – sticking with Tesla powertrains and battery systems?
No, no. I've actually never used Tesla powertrains. A lot of people think we do, but we do not because that's a dead end street for my client for support. If he can't get parts or service, what are we going to do?
Okay.
So, no, I
but the batteries you like.
Additionally, yes, I've used their batteries. But, I mean, those are junkyard sorts. I mean, that's not viable either.
Okay.
And Elon has no interest in opening up battery sales. We're meeting and investigating a couple up-and-coming battery sciences companies that are presenting themselves to be highly adaptable with battery modules that can morph depending on the platform dynamics. And that's exciting.
And then so, you know, if you're battery packs, right, they're kind of like, you know, for Tesla and now for Lucid Rivian, they're sort of designed to fit those vehicles.
Yep.
And you're using, I assume, with like an electric FJ, it's still the same chassis, the Art Morrison chassis. So how are you fitting batteries, or what are you losing when you stick batteries in, or how hard is it to get enough batteries?
You pick what you're going to sacrifice, and you throw the batteries in, and you're done. Or you geek out and go, okay, weight distribution, where do I want that weight? Up high, down low, front, left, what's the balance, what's the metric? And then networking them, if they're distributed throughout a platform, is a whole nother challenge. So, you know, in a perfect world, to me, you put them where the gas tank was and you put them where the engine was and then the motors where the tranny was. And then you got to figure out where to put the damn transfer case and how to make the transfer case quieter. Because that's the other thing. Like resto-modding with a big block, you know, putting a LS9 in a 49 Hudson is one thing.
Right.
Putting an electric powertrain into a 49 Merc or Hudson or whatever is a whole different thing because every little squeak and rattle and nuance that you never stood a chance of hearing over
now
the beautiful verbal,
you hear
everything.
Well, wait. You said transfer case. So you're still using – you still need a transfer case with the electric motors?
Yeah.
Why
is
that?
Dana has solid axle assemblies with motors and short shafts, or I kind of wish everyone hadn't abandoned the in-wheel hub motors, but That's one way to go.
Okay.
Or you do a traditional driveline
position. So real quick, though,
you need the gear reduction?
You need the gear reduction because of the existing hardware. The
basically, the axle route isn't viable because the track width, sourceability, et cetera, is not yet consistent in that world, which means I go with a conventional setup – motor where the sort of transmission, as we say conventional, look how quick changes, right?
Yeah.
So the motor where a conventional tranny would go, then gear reducer, then either conjoined or divorced transfer case, then to drive shafts, then to axles.
Okay.
Is it perfect? No.
Right.
But I had to kind of look, okay, I need to be able to use as much of the proven non-reoccurring engineering elements that are successful that we've built hundreds of in our current platform and then adapt to EV.
Right.
If this was a rich man's hobby and some big funding company owned me and was happy to call it a write-off and party on, hell yeah, I'd go to axle-based powertrains.
Got it.
Well, okay. Would you ever consider Rivian's approach, which is a motor essentially at each wheel?
Yes.
And then you
– Definitely. I think it's if like they did, right, had the luxury to clean the table, grease boards raw, what are we going to do? I think that's the optimum approach.
Yeah. Then you eliminate all the heavy stuff.
Yeah.
All the heavy stuff goes away,
yeah.
Right?
So, yeah.
Okay.
Very cool.
It sounds like a lot of work, man.
It is.
Just go back to doing watches and leather and stuff, right?
Don't tempt me. But going back to changes in the market, all the people coming in the market space, the key point that my rambling head wanted to make there is that now there are, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 companies that came to market with EV FJs or EV Broncos or EV Thriftmasters using kind of very, in my humble opinion, low grade content to be first to market, which then means my whole team is, anyone who has to answer the phone is driven nuts by new or existing clients of, well, so-and-so's doing it. Why aren't you doing it? All right, here we go. Once that gear reduction came in, then I know I can deliver the right product.
I want to ask you a hard question, though.
Yeah.
Okay, and this is going to – you mentioned this in some of your prep work about – the other day we were talking about with James Marsden, we were talking about quartz versus mechanical watches and that whole thing, right? But since you're – how many vehicles a year does Icon produce?
36-ish.
Okay, very small.
Yeah.
Do you need to be doing EVs? In other words – since the whole industry is going quartz, going EV, can't you just be more profitable?
I mean, why would you put it like that?
Yeah,
like I have a problem with
it
because I don't own a single quartz.
You know what? You're right.
This watch is from 1908 and it's doing just damn fine as long as I remember to wind.
Right. So you hear what I'm saying? If you're actually worried about disposable cars and EVs becoming a thing, shouldn't you just stay as even more mechanical?
No, because we have to be culturally relevant.
Okay.
So there was an interesting article I saw online that was talking about people converting classics, et cetera, and it's not the way to go to change the world. Well, no, right? At best, my vehicle is somebody's secondary vehicle or their primary vehicle at a specific property to engage with a specific
when they're on their island.
So I'm not going to change the world and free the oceans of plastic and oiled pipelines in everyone's backyard. Culturally, though, it keeps us engaging with newer generations of consumers or different sects of our current generation. Just like when we came out, when we first started Icon, you guys remember we just had New School, right?
Yep.
Because I had to communicate a different design language for people to understand that we are re-engineering the whole vehicle to honor the aesthetic, but it is a complete revolution in the user experience. I had to have a design language unique, hence New School. Well, once enough people fortunately knew about the brand and what it meant, then I could go introduce Old School, which got more retro. So happy we did that. It's a completely different customer base. We have a lot more women coming to the brand because it's less technical aggro man. It's more tactile, fun, funky retro and the coloration and trim and bright work and all that. I see EV as part of that
change as well. But there's, you know, some companies now in Europe. I was just reading about a company that's doing low-cost conversion kits for things like the Fiat Panda and for the 500 and stuff. Well, that's different, right? Because now you're dealing with regulations in a lot of areas, a lot of municipal areas where you can't bring a certain vehicle of a certain displacement or vintage into the urban center without it. So we accelerate the landfill issue again.
I just want to say that was an annoyingly good answer. So.
Oh, my bad.
Well, I also wanted to bring up because, again, your products are unique in the quality and the time you spend on making them sort of perfect. And you called out some OEMs that you thought were doing it right, and including Volvo for their sustainability in the fabric.
Yeah, but not just the fabric. Like this whole Polestar program is starting to look at both energy consumed by the plant or in transit from the tier two to tier one, that's a huge one, by the suppliers. To the plastics and
green
the interior
steel.
The textile and like and on and on and on. And even Michelin is starting to look at non-petroleum based tire compounds that are pretty
well. I wanted to bring this home to you because as a guy who does leather work in your spare time, how do you feel about
– it's a byproduct of the meat industry. None of the cows, horses, or anything that the tanneries are sourcing were raised solely for that. Okay. It's literally a byproduct.
Okay.
Same with alligator, which is a bit more controversial, but alligators haven't been on the endangered species list since the 70s. In fact, now, same with boas now in the southeast U.S. are a major problem.
There's a glut.
So the alligator permit program that this American CITES program is actually a global system now started has been the most successful fundraiser and conservation effort ever in U.S. history for preserving wetland and wildland while dealing with a public nuisance, especially as people move further and further out. Right. But yeah, I do all veg tanned, organically tanned, sustainable leather, and it's all a byproduct of an existing.
But do you have any interest in that other side? Like, do you have clients who want an all vegan interior, or have you done?
I mean, like, I read the
good thing this is on video, too. If you're listening,
he just had made a face.
Good face.
I was in Italy last month at a big trade show for the leather industry called Lina Appel. And there's definitely a greenwashing happening in that industry as well.
Of course. Yeah.
But if you look at the chromium and some of the really nasty used in leather tanning is gnarly.
Right.
But if you go back in history to when it was oak bark and then berries and fruits and different plant
derivatives. Or the brain of the animal, right? Didn't they?
No, even gut and brain. But there's a huge shift in tanneries back to the traditional organic tanning
and
process.
And that makes the leather better, longer lasting?
Oh, lasts longer. Right. Like the environmental impact's almost net neutral. And it lasts.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because, we talked about Volvo, but BMW – They're like we're not sourcing conflict cobalt, there'll be no child slave labor. Like we are not going to ignore where our suppliers are getting this stuff from. Like we're dictating to them, we want lithium that's not.
How about
from
the cotton though? Where's the cotton from?
Leather world now, there's two companies that are and I went to Lyon and visited the tannery in Mexico that was doing one of these two things. But one is cactus leather.
Mm, yes,
and the other is ordered some cactus belts that never showed up.
Leather,
Are they good?
No, I don't think so. And you can't finish them in the traditional senses. So you have to use automated machinery and stuff, which goes against sort of my artisanal brain.
Right.
But look, at the end of the day, at this time in culture, I worry that we're all so divided and we're all judges, right? Everyone's either left or right or wrong or right. And everyone is so quick to judge and chew each other out culturally. At some point, you have to pick your battles, right? Okay, let's say tomorrow morning we flip a switch and somehow the world goes to EV. Okay, where's all the ore coming from that's needed for current battery sciences?
Sure.
What strife is that going to create in different cultures and different economies? And what is that? What other industries need it? And what support issues are we going to face there? Or look at water. So at some point, like, you either go, well, we're f***ed if we do, we're f***ed if we don't. Or you go, you know what? I'm just going to do what I can sleep well knowing I did.
Yeah.
and moves that's the point needle in the ways I can control them.
That's the point you kind of got to get to.
Because otherwise, at the end of the day, who am I? I build a couple dozen cars a year.
Yeah. Well, otherwise, you get to the point where you're like, well, the problem is just too many humans. You know, and that
right.
produces
and
like
Darwin didn't really show up and you know, trim the herd in the ways that we'd always dreamed it would. You know, it seems right. indiscriminate, which kind of wasn't the way to go.
COVID's kind of doing that.
Not fast enough. Wait, we're getting off.
No, not efficiently enough. Like, they're not by their right metrics,
right. And who has those metrics?
We need a CAN bus Darwin.
Right. Wow. Very good. Well, but getting back to watches for a second, because I don't think we can end a Jonathan Ward interview without talking about watches. You have designed a couple.
Yep. Okay. Well, just one.
Just the one? The
well, designed and executed one, designed about 20 that my wife won't let me build until I sell. I think I have 3 doozies left, but she is not – she is needed to keep my crazy ass on a leash.
Right. She's the CFO. Right. Yeah.
So like, I'm like, honey, we're well in the black. We're good to go. Let's do the next one. No. Finish up first.
Okay.
But I mean, in her defense also, I mean, I'm designing a property of a full ranch. I'm designing a huge car collection compound of buildings. I have a chair design that I'm releasing in the first quarter. I have belt buckles at foundries that I'm developing and designing. I have a whole leather goods brand and leather jackets. So I am a bit all over the place, so I do need a leash.
Okay. I was going to say.
Not a mushroom leash.
Yeah. Leather. Veggie dyed. Can you use mushroom as a dye for leather?
I suppose at some point you could. But.
Okay. No, but I was going to ask back to the watch thing, though. Was going to. Your answer is better than the question I was going to ask. Yeah. No, I was just going to say, like, are you still designing watches or have you?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
So you haven't stopped with
GMT
anything.
GMT is next, right? That's what I.
Yeah, that's what I want. Either World Time or GMT are the next two plans.
But you haven't stopped with anything. Like, you keep expanding. Because you told me that you're thinking about, like, really doing the leather thing full time. Like, that'll become.
Well, here's the number one challenge is the realities during COVID and the realities of running a light industrial business in California have turned my life into a complicated show that I've never seen. So retaining talent, keeping sublets on track and productive, sourcing materials, and the crazy inflation we're seeing in prices and in labor force means that, for example, at Icon, our core automotive interests, I'm doing less and less of these crazy derelict and reformer one-offs because my team's always allowed me to do them because they're incredibly engaging and kind of client-funded skunk works. Like we get to explore.
And they get a lot of media attention.
Yeah, they get media love and on and on. But they're brutally expensive and the least profitable thing we do. Sometimes they're net losers.
Right.
But the core business is the production, using the term lightly, vehicles that we repeatedly build. I have 15 open positions right now. Building and safety up my ass for erroneous cash grab. I've got to focus on keeping the core machinery working. The amount of time that my sourcing team and management staff and myself are having to spend on jumping through hoops to find alternate suppliers or air freight. And I'm Mr. America when it comes to sourcing. I've always been hell-bent on U.S. sourcing. Well, now the curtain's getting drawn back and we're realizing even though it's a U.S.-made or U.S.-based company, the key content is still coming from other countries, which is still tied to this global issue.
Right.
So a lot of these things, either they're nights and weekends, I don't sleep much, and I can develop them on my off work time. Sharif and my key team at Icon is so brilliant, I'd be dead without them. That the even with these challenges, the company is running well and customer demand's higher than ever.
Crazy. That's great.
Great. Killer.
That's great.
But not killer if I can't staff and maintain, not to mention expand to meet that need.
I mean, I get the and I kind of mentioned this earlier, like sounds like a lot of work. It also doesn't sound like a lot of fun, basically, from where you started in the beginning, right? Like,
yeah, I unfortunately have to agree with you that when it was just me smoking a joint in my 2-car garage, building with music blaring, and my biggest problem was keeping my neighbors from getting pissed about the 20 crap cars parked on our cul-de-sac. That was one thing, right? So then as the business has grown and 50 employees, 100,000 square feet, you know, bigger concerns, liabilities, multiple projects going, two things have happened. One is I'm probably the worst TIG welder in the shop. So I'm no longer a value in the shop. I used to handle everything myself.
Right.
Now I'm, you know, running different things. I'm still running design. I do the first iteration CAD. Now I have proper electrical engineers and mechanical engineers that make me, you know, make my stupid ideas actually work.
Right.
But at the same time, I realized I was losing that. I'm all about the tactile, right? So I was losing that connection, which is why I started up the leathercraft hobby. Because very simple, right. Someone off to college, take over his room, redo it, turn it into a little hack studio. And I can go from a drawing to a CAD file to a finished good in a very satisfying, dopamine-creating period of time. Mm-hmm. Now you look at these one-offs, I'm sold out 5-6 years into the future. It's irresponsible to take more of those given all of the variables that have been introduced into modern post-COVID, during COVID business realities. So I'm having to like make sure I'm developing things that don't hinder my commitment to my existing clients. So like the BMW project, we got through all the complex stuff. I had to can the entire project. Because at the end of the day, if you're going to put on your big boy pants and look at the business,
right.
And I've maybe too much have entertained the passionate goober in me and not the business.
Not the business person.
Right. That versus electrifying the existing programs that are already succeeding and active, I'd be a dumbass to add another even more complicated program to a crew that I'm having enough trouble staffing and growing. Sure. Much easier to electrify. And also culturally, the relevance. So I'm basically at 51 trying to grow up.
On that note, I think we've actually gone like way over the amount of time we have.
Every time you and I get together,
I know. We'll continue this in your backyard with cigars very shortly, hopefully.
Yeah.
But this has been good. It's been a lot.
It's awesome.
We didn't talk enough
with Land Cruiser for my taste, so we'll have to continue this.
I wanted Jonathan to tell us what the future of cars is going to be. We didn't even get to that, so we'll have to have you back.
We'll have to have you back.
Anyways, Jonathan Ward of Icon, thank you so much.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for letting us rant. And if you're still listening, I'm proud of you.
Thank you.